everyone. This is Robert Stark. My guest here for today is Charles Lincoln. Before we get to our topic for today, I think a good way for us to start off is let's talk about how we met.
Well, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Go ahead, exactly.
Well, I was in touch with, I was living in Los Angeles at the time, in West LA by UCLA, and I was getting increasingly frustrated with the fact that really I didn't have anybody to talk to about some of my political and ideological beliefs, that everybody I knew out here was kind of, at best, you know, kind of a moderate conservative Tea Party type person, maybe some on the libertarian side. And so I started looking around and I found this gentleman I had heard of before by the name of William D. Johnson. And I had heard of him before from other, you know, from years gone by. And it turned out he was a lawyer downtown Los Angeles, and I wanted to meet him. And so I contacted him. This is about 2 years ago now, I guess. We met in Santa Monica and hit it off very, very quickly and found out we had a lot in common and knew some people. And I said, I have not found anybody in West Los Angeles or Santa Monica who has any particularly interesting views or beliefs on the question of race.
Well, I guess what I can get at is, what is so remarkable about Los Angeles that you would say that basically what you would say to someone who has never been to LA? What would you say about it that is remarkable about it, and how does that relate to other greater issues that we're going to be discussing?
Well, there are many things one would say about Los Angeles. I don't know, the last night, you know, there was a movie about, you may recall I was about to go see a movie about Los Angeles air pollution, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It was called The Desolation of Smog. Yeah, L.A. is famous for its smog. I guess most people know that. Bad joke, all right, sorry.
It's true, but it's not what we're going to be discussing.
Well, you asked what I would tell people about this.
Okay.
But basically, pollution of the air, I think, is kind of related to other concepts, if you think about it, because basically, why do we have pollution of the air? It's because the city is overcrowded. Why is it overcrowded? It's because basically people have moved here from all over the world for the wonderful climate. And what has happened to the wonderful climate since everybody moved here? Well, the climate isn't so wonderful anymore. I have to say that since I was in high school here, they have done wonderful things with air pollution. But
yeah, I mean, it was bad. Actually, air pollution was at its worst in the 1950s in L.A. when the population was much smaller.
And
it
was still very bad in the 70s, too. I mean, the sunny California had become a complete myth. I don't know if it was worse in the 50s. I think it was probably worse in the 60s and 70s, actually. And that's when I was in high school out here. But in the 70s, things were already developing in relation to the issues that William Johnson and I were talking about and that brought you and me together ultimately, which was the fact that overpopulation has been accomplished by changing the composition of California. Now, when I was a kid, I remember my grandfather talking about his first trip out to California in the 1920s. He was born in Galveston, Texas. And in the 1920s, he and a friend of his from college took a Model T and drove all around the U.S. together. And, you know, this was like their big thing on graduating from college. And he said, California is the most amazing place. This is, you know, this man in his 70s going on his 80s telling me this, of course. California's most amazing place. The girls are so beautiful. It's all blonde. The ugliest girl out there would be a beauty queen back here. He had just never seen any place like it in his life. And that was, of course, the California legend, the beautiful, that became famous all over the world, really. By the 1950s, you had the Beach Boys singing about California Dreaming, the Beach Boys, that was the Mamas and the Papas.
You have that on your Skype. I see your Skype account has California Dreaming on Such a Winter's Day, but obviously all that stuff, for the most part, it's all gone.
It is completely
ruined. Not all gone, but but there's some small pockets. But for the most part, I mean, it's been totally ruined.
And the reasons are so interesting. The reasons are not entirely natural. They are up to a point manufactured, I think. California has been the great experiment in global melting pot politics. I think it's fair to say, not just Los Angeles, but also, the Bay Area. They brought in the Chinese. Well, I mean, first, it's kind of funny. First, we conquered the Mexicans. We took Mexico from California. We took California from Mexico. We didn't really force anyone out, but the Anglos, because of the gold rush, rapidly overwhelmed the original Spanish population. And the Indians were pretty much wiped out. Tiny little groups of Indians survived only. But then, because right after the American Civil War, when California had opted to be opted to come in as a free state rather than a slave state, right after the American Civil War, California suddenly found itself in need of cheap labor, and so they had a few Chinese coming over during the gold rush, and they basically started admitting a wave after wave of Chinese to come work on the railroads and do other forms of manual labor. And this is really the very first time, I think, in any part of American history that free labor had been imported to supply the needs of a growing economy for cheap labor. And of course, this has become a routine theme over and over and over again in American history. First, we brought in indentured servants from England and Ireland as cheap labor. Then we brought in black African slaves, which is, I think, what we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. But then we brought in the Chinese. Then we brought in cheap labor from Eastern Europe. It's Italians and Slavs and Russians and large population Poles came to different parts of the U.S. from all over Europe. And in the past 30 to 40 years, what's happened is Los Angeles has become sort of, some people call it the capital of the third world. It is one of the largest Mexican cities. If it were inside of Mexico, it would be the largest, it would be the third largest Mexican city.
Yeah, I mean, all these different countries have their claim to LA as the largest group outside the country. It's not just Mexico, right. I'm sure Korea, Iran, Armenia, Israel, different countries.
Israel, I don't know, it might be
close. New York. No, Israel would be New York, of course, but definitely Iran, South Korea, Korea, maybe the Philippines, a whole bunch of El Salvador, Guatemala, a whole bunch of countries.
As we were discussing yesterday, there's actually a government in exile of Iran based here in Los Angeles, with the son of the last reigning Shah actually having been crowned in Los Angeles sometime in the 1980s. It's a fascinating place in many ways, but what it means is that that beautiful colony of, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed Nordic types that my grandfather was so impressed by in the 1920s has basically been overwhelmed in purely demographic terms and is now basically highly prized for modeling, both high-end Hollywood type modeling and, you know,
and the porn industry
and then just downright dirty strippers, and you know, the sex trade, basically. And this is a very strange tragedy in a lot of ways, because the world has kind of been turned upside down. And this is very much, I think, what we're aiming to talk about, is that in California in particular, and Los Angeles, just because it's so obvious and such a major center of the media, we're stuck with a situation where white people are kind of almost an endangered species. And if we look around, we see all sorts of reasons we're thinking that white people are an endangered species. And one of the strange things that's happening, and I have run into this all over the country, but in particular in Los Angeles, is that not only are white people are an endangered species, but white people are very apologetic about the fact that they still exist at all, even though basically from the standpoint of Hollywood and the modeling industry that we're talking about, their beauty is still sort of emblematic of what it means to be beautiful.
Yeah, I remember, do you know William Johnson was on this show? There's a British actor named Russell Brand, and William Johnson was making an argument for racialism, and Russell Brand was saying, "Well, I like the diversity because there's more of a variety of women I can sleep with." But the thing is, like, when Russell Brand is in L.A., he's in the Hollywood crowd surrounded by a lot of beautiful white women, and basically with a handful of the best-looking women of different ethnic groups. But that basically is not the reality in Southern California as a whole. He's basically defending his position against William Johnson by being among the whole sort of Hollywood crowd of L.A., but that is not the norm in Southern California.
Well, diversity, of course, in itself is a very strange argument, because diversity is... L.A. is held out to be one of the models of diversity in the world. But now, what does that really mean? It means you bring a bunch of people who look different together, and then they meet and they get married, mate. However, marriage isn't all that important in most of LA sex these days, be perfectly honest about it. But the diversity, by bringing people together, you make them share their space, that's obvious. You make them interact with each other, and you make them start exchanging things. Obviously, the biggest reason is you exchange money and labor. That's the reason a lot of people are here, is for jobs, and or to offer jobs or take jobs.
And then they end up exchanging bodily fluids.
Well, okay, let's not get gross.
Okay.
Let's not get gross, but what I was going to say first was that they started exchanging ideas, and they start exchanging, by an exchange of ideas, their ideas become more alike. They start, exchanging their kinds of cuisine. And so, for example, you know,
we ate at P.F. Chang's last night, but that's kind of a corporatized version of ethnic cuisine, but it was good food.
It's basically called, Oriental fusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fusion. The distinction between China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, Thailand is, for the most part, completely lost on a menu that has sushi and noodles and dumplings and wonton all mixed up together. And from the standpoint of the American, okay, that's all Asian. But from the standpoint of individual countries in Asia, that means that their identity is being eroded. The distinction between Vietnam and Japan, Korea and Thailand is being completely forgotten, and even the different regions of China, from Sichuan to Cantonese to Shanghai, Manchuria and are being completely wiped out. And, of course, that was actually one of the goals of Chairman Mao and the Cultural Revolution. And, again, one of the things that we often talk about is that the goal of abolishing the differences between people is part of the communist world plan for one global civilization, basically.
Well, it's not so much the real communist, but more so the Frankfurt School and the cultural Marxist, I would say. But there's a distinction between those groups.
Well, I mean, the Frankfurt School.
Yeah.
The Frankfurt School was particularly interested in this because they found that the original economic goals of China, of communism, were not taking as much root in Europe as they had hoped. It wasn't moving things forward as fast as they had hoped. But I think that going back, the original Communist Manifesto and Marx and Lenin's original opinion was very much they were looking towards global government, world government, and a single world system. So I don't think that it was really a great break with the original communism. But what's interesting is that, of course, that the Frankfurt School has spawned this strange cultural revolution inside the United States, which I really think is extremely strange and internally contradictory, and very hard to follow, really, what their logic is, except that it destroys the status quo. It destroys whatever exists has to be destroyed, is what it comes down to. And that's very hard to take in a lot of ways. And one of the ways in which it's hard to take is that diversity, as I was moving towards saying, is a self-defeating program. You bring people together, and what happens? They become more alike. First, in superficial ways, perhaps, then in more deep cultural ways, and then finally they mate, they amalgamate, they miscegenate, and they become all one.
Yeah, exactly. So the end result of it is basically, it's not diversity, it's homogenization. You have a bunch of people with some kind of... You have a bunch of people who are ethnically a big mix, but they all basically shop at the same... They all go to the Apple store, they all go to Starbucks. It's a monolithic corporate culture, so it wipes out the real diversity.
And it becomes a rather ugly culture and boring culture without any diversity at all. And, I mean, we do, in fact, see that increasingly all over the United States and the world. That global corporate culture is the antithesis of isolated populations developing unique and unusual customs and habits. It wipes out all of that. It relegates all of that to the realm of memory. And even memory is under attack. And I think that that was possibly what we were really planning on talking about today was the purpose of a certain movements inside mainstream religion to erase and alter memory, the memory of history, the understanding of history is very poor to begin with among the American people. Our educational system does not emphasize it nearly as much as it used to. The fact that most students never even learn a second language, a second living language, much less, ancient languages like Latin or Greek. Unless these elements are part of their home education, most children live and grow up in a world dominated by television and video games, which are inherently homogeneous, globalist products to begin with. I was talking about the assault on memory and how American education is so weak that most people have a very poorly fixed notion of history and especially details of cultural history, much less economic history, even of the past 200 years since the foundation of the American Republic, 250 years almost now. It's fascinating to me that this is unrelenting. And I guess one thing that I supremely regret is that my own church, the Episcopal Church of the United States, has effectively joined the Frankfurt School. I hate to say it, but most of the clergy in the Episcopal Church seem to be basically Frankfurt School cultural Marxists. And nothing grieves me more than that the Church of England, the very first of all the national churches of the United, not of the United States, but of the world, the very first country that identified the needs of a people to understand the Bible in national terms, their own language, with the creation of a distinctive liturgy, distinctive church, and the need for a homogeneous population. My church was born in that, the first birth of nationalism, basically, in modern Europe, that accompanied the Protestant Reformation. The first burst of nationalism that created the Church of England and ultimately shepherded the British Empire and Anglo-American culture, Anglo-American, Australian, Canadian culture, into basically the dominant culture of the world as it is today. That's both good and bad in so many ways. It's also been basically the mother of this current corporate globalist world, which is very unfortunate. But isn't it ironic that it all started with nationalism and the creation of a national church in England, and that that is now the goal of the current the current clergy of the Anglican Communion as a whole, is to abolish that distinctive identity and to erase it, and to erase the memory of how we actually got to where we are today. And that was the original topic that we were going to schedule, was to discuss a very strange event that's happening on January 18th of next year. We're about 5 weeks away from it now, just barely 5 weeks away from it, in New Orleans, which is where I live now. I went to college many years ago, birthplace of my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, I should say. And I just am deeply, deeply disturbed that my church, which I used to consider, to have achieved such a high degree of cultural sophistication basically from the time of Queen Elizabeth I through Victoria, those 300 years of English history, I think that the Church of England represented some of the best in terms of moral Christian thought anywhere in the world. And it did so in building up the individual, supporting individual freedom, at the same time of supporting national identity and the preservation of one England and one English culture and one English church together.
But one thing I will say about the Episcopal Church in America is it has traditionally been associated with the upper class. I think it is basically per capita is the wealthiest Christian denomination. And basically, this ideology that you're talking about is the ideology of the ruling class in this country, so it would make sense for that church to fully embrace the ideas such as cultural Marxism.
Well, I think that's a perverse thing you just said. The upper class should support its own destruction. That's a very strange statement you just made, because, of course, in the history of how the Episcopal Church of the United States became associated with the upper class has to do with what we were talking about in the first 20 minutes before we got cut off about the waves of immigration. Really, the only reason in England, in Scotland, in Wales, Northern Ireland, Canada, Australia, the Church of New Zealand, for that matter, the Church of England is the predominant church. Most people are members of the Church of England.
Yeah, I mean, I actually lived in England briefly. In England, it's the dominant church for everyone of different classes. But I would say in America, it's sort of associated more with the upper class.
Well, let me continue to say the why. Now, why is that true? The reason that's true is because of these waves of immigration. The waves of immigration first brought in Catholics, and then they brought in Germans and other people who were not associated with the Church of England. And, you know, last night we ran into some Mennonites who are basically German descendants, Protestants, but of a particular sect that is outside either the Roman Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church, or the Church of England. And basically with each successive wave of immigration, the original settlers of Tidewater, Virginia, and the Carolinas became a smaller and smaller percentage of the population. Now, of course, in New England, there was a strange situation that New England itself was founded in large part by dissenters from the Church of England. The Pilgrims were not members of the Church of England. The Pilgrims were, children of a different creed who basically they wanted to simplify and go further towards towards a pure version of Protestantism than the Episcopalians, the Anglicans had ever gone.
Yeah, because the Anglican Church has a lot of similarities to Catholicism.
Well, what used to be said was that the English Church represented a middle path, via in aurea mediocritas, the way of the golden mean between Rome and the Protestant Reformation, that basically the English Church was going to endorse translation of the Bible and making the biblical text available to every person to read and interpret for himself, and that it wouldn't be dependent on that your reading of the Bible would not be dependent upon either priests or the interpretation mandated from Rome. And they decapitated the Roman Church, quite literally. They rejected the Pope, the 200 years of English history from Henry VIII to the early 18th century is all about the battle between England and the papacy, basically. After the final defeat of the Stuarts in 1745, that really didn't seem to be much of an issue anymore. But the hierarchy, of course, was reinforced by the fact that the Irish, who were, for totally non-religious reasons, the subject of English oppression, the Irish were Catholic, and so up north, in particular, more than in the south, the Irish were under the heel of Protestants generally, and even in New England, by the 18th century, the association of the royal government with the Church of England was such that the Church of England was kind of getting the upper hand over the Puritans and the Presbyterians, even in New England. And then in New York, the same thing. So it was the association of the royal government with the colonial regime that gave the Church of England a higher status. And combining that with the fact that the Dutch reformed, Lutherans, they were in some sense the conquered people. For the most part, they assimilated and mixed with the Anglos in New York. But you still got basically a segregation based on religious lines, which correlated with class lines, and again, that's part of where the whole confusion, I think, started, was that under the American Constitution of 1787, there was this presumption that all religions were going to be treated alike, at least by the federal government. And the notion of equality and alike treatment is, again, one of the myths, or one of the founding principles, depending on how you want to regard it, that has effectively tortured America from its foundation. Do we want everyone really to be treated exactly alike? And again, I want to get to this concept of what's going on in the Episcopal Church right now, because I think that yesterday you and I listened to part of the preparation for that took place November 15th in Jackson, Mississippi, and it raised some interesting questions about these issues of race and the foundations of America and of the American way of life, and really the world way of life, that are very interesting. And I think that the issues that we ought to discuss today are, A, what is the historical truth of white-black race relations in America? B, what are the sources of economic inequality between blacks and whites? And C, is there any sort of race that makes it desirable either to mix or not to mix the races biologically?
I watched the video with you, but they did not talk about anything concrete. It was all about this sort of feel good stuff about you have a lot of stuff to talk about, but I think what they have to talk about, it's not that there's nothing of substance, but if you want to summarize what they're saying at the Episcopal Church at this convention in Mississippi, you can go ahead.
Well, I don't really want to summarize it. I just wanted to say that I think that you could discern a few kernels of important points to discuss from that talk. One was the internal contradiction. On the one hand, the presiding bishop started off in her keynote address, Catherine Jeffers Shorey, by saying that race had to be learned, and racism has to be learned, and that's why it should be eradicated, because it's merely a cultural construct. And then she said almost immediately, it is an unlearned, it is in our subconscious. And I stopped it right there, if you recall, and I said, wow, what an amazing thing. We should eradicate racism because it's merely a cultural construct that comes from our unconscious. Now, that struck, purely psychological standpoint, you know, whether we agree with Freud or not, you know, it struck me as, wow, okay, so I guess we should get rid of the Oedipus complex. We should get rid of all Jungian archetypes. All things that occur in the unconscious mind need to be wiped out. And then what are you left with?
Nothing. You know? You have an empty mind.
Well, you might find a bunch of really sick, insane people. And I think that up to a point, modern culture is driving people crazy precisely because it attacks the basic structures of their psychology.
Yeah, that is basically what modern culture is. Basically, as two components, you have to learn how to – you basically learn how to make money, which obviously with the economic situation, that's no longer always feasible. And the other thing is you fill your head with useless pop culture that you get from TV. And that's basically what the modern psyche is all about.
Well, I mean, let's think about why is it so important to absorb modern culture? It's so important because it's our only product. What does America produce other than useless pop culture? I mean, other than, you know, Miley Cyrus and Britney Spears and similar things, what do people talk about in the mainstream media? That is at the top of every Yahoo page every day. I mean, even the day Mandela died, you know, there were still little news items about Miley Cyrus and Britney Spears over there because, hey, they're what our friend Melinda calls Pop Tarts. They are what everybody really seems to care about and what everybody wants to think about. And this is what it goes. I go back. This it erases history. It erases anything of any importance from our consciousness.
So yeah, the key things that that are being erased are basically there's history, culture, ethnicity, and even religion. Though we're talking about a religious institution, but I'd say the big core things are, I guess, nationality, ethnicity, and culture.
Yeah, and basically they're trying to rewrite religion in the strangest possible way. They're taking the Church of England, and the Church of England is advocating basically what you might call mass WASP suicide, at least cultural suicide. And I want to get back to the points that I wanted to develop from the conference you were listening to yesterday. That contradiction in the presiding bishop's words about whether race is a learned cultural construct or an inherent state of mind continued in the discussion. Another one of the points that was valuable was made by one of the African American participants in the conference, who said that equality is an economic concept. Justice is a commercial concept. He would use the word commercial, not economic. Is that law itself is about commerce, and you know that raised the whole issue was, okay, if we agree with him, and I think one could almost agree with him on these points, is race something we should be reconciling at all, or is race merely a distraction from the real issues, which are in fact economic?
I would say that basically what he said about race and economic justice, I mean, technically, I don't disagree with him. He does have a valid point, but what I would point out is places like L.A., where that are extremely diverse, there is, in a sense, a extreme inequality. In a sense, L.A. actually has a caste, an economic, socioeconomic, racial caste system based on the economic structure. So he is right, but the current system actually creates what he is supposedly against, in a sense.
Well, now we're making some progress.
Okay.
We're getting back to my big criticism of the whole concept of this ecumenical mass for racial reconciliation.
The key thing is you're saying that diversity creates inequality and it creates one group. Because basically in L.A., the people, I mean, if you're the working class whites, obviously that group gets screwed over the most. But the white people who have the money in Southern California, I mean, they're doing pretty well.
Well, I was not exactly saying that diversity creates inequality. I was saying that the modern economic system, the modern political system, which includes as part of its ideology diversity, creates a kind of inequality of a scale that's simply unimaginable, for example, in the Old South. In the Old South, the difference between the rich white planters, supposedly rich white planters, and the poor sharecroppers and blacks who worked for them might have been of a factor of, you know, 10 to 20 times as rich. maybe the richest people in the traditionally in the old South were 10 to 20 times as rich as those who worked for
Well,
them.
But I would slightly disagree with you in a sense. I think the system in the old South under slavery has a well. I don't think it was such a great thing because it basically is similar to our current system, where you have basically the wealthiest people who want to exploit large amounts of cheap non-white labor. So I would say there are similarities. So I don't think that South was necessarily such a great system.
I wasn't really saying that it was. I mean, you weren't listening carefully. What I was talking about was the degree of economic difference between the richest and the poorest in society.
Yeah, I get that. I agree with you there. So I'm not saying I disagree with you, but I just think that's worth pointing out. But your main point was the amount of income inequality is far more extreme today than it was back then.
Exactly. LA in particular, LA and New York are two centers of a global economy where the difference between the average of the wealthiest and the average of the poorest is not on the order of 10 to 20 times. The difference is on the order of 200 to 10,000 times. We have these super millionaires living within miles. Millionaires is really almost nothing. Millionaires is basically the middle class these days. It's at least in California. If you've got a house and a car, it's hard not to be a millionaire, right? I mean, it doesn't mean much. But if you've got a situation where there are people who make hundreds of millions compared with people who are barely making the minimum wage or not, that is a scale of inequality that the Old South never created, because the Old South never created any economy of such exaggerated proportions, because it was based on the production of something real. It was based on agricultural production. It was based on hard money capital, not credit economy. Everything in LA is based on a credit economy. And because credit is at least theoretically infinite, that means that the inequalities that can be produced by the credit economy are essentially infinite.
Yeah, I mean, there are basically no real capital is when you actually produce a product. Most of the jobs, our economy is totally based on retail, and a retail-based economy is obviously a product of a credit-based economy.
Well, and what you're looking at, when you were talking about pop culture, you know, pop culture basically is a purely consumer matter. I mean, it takes actual things like, you know, microphones and cameras and recorders and broadcasting equipment to create pop culture. A few stores, I don't know, brick stores where you circulate these, although even brick record and film stores are going the way of the dodo these days, because everything's done online, and because everything online is cost free, people are constantly trying to figure out ways to make the intangible harder to get. You know, Disney is trying to claim perpetual copyrights on the figures created in the past 60 to 70 years in its cartoons. They don't want any of this ever to go into the public domain. And because of the ease of producing what you can only call intellectual property, artistic property, is so great compared to the human labor and the amount of technology, say, to require to do the production of food, the technology is all there, but the product is nothing. The product is literally sound and wind, and nothing more. That is what pop culture is, and it's as ephemeral as sound and wind. We are engaged in producing as much as most popular culture is worth right now. You know, we're talking and breathing while we talk, and our words are only interesting to a very few people. And pop culture, if it were not for the system that supports it, would be interesting to only very few people. And the survival of America is basically dependent upon the production, the commercialization, really, of sound and air, especially as encapsulated over the internet and over forms of other forms of electronic communication. Our society produces nothing. And in a society that produces nothing of any tangible value, what do we do? What can we do to promote any sort of equality? Those who control the media are those who will be not the top 1%, but more like the top 0.1% compared with the incomes of the people in South Central LA and Compton and Watts and many of the other neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about LA because LA is the future. The video from the Episcopal Church, it focused very much on the civil rights movement, but I remember like when I was in high school and in middle school, basically, race relations in America is always taught about in the context of the South. And I know you have a strong personal connection to the South, but at the same time, I think it's important to change the dichotomy. So I think we should be talking more about LA, which is the future, instead of focusing the racial dichotomy in America on the history in the South.
Well, I mean, the dialogue everywhere is about the South. I mean, is that a distraction program? Yes, it probably is. But I mean, all the movies that have come out over the past couple of years ago, back in a little over a year ago, you and I went to see
Lincoln, yeah.
Which was a falsified statement of the creation of the 13th Amendment. Not long after that, there was a movie which I simply refused to see called Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. I did not see it, but I read enough about it to know that it was a rather crude mythologization of Civil War history to say that all the Southerners were vampires. And then you got to the summer when they had the Butler. I don't know if you saw the Butler or not, but the Butler was a big hit.
You certainly, for someone who's against pop culture, you certainly consume a lot of it. But I guess you have to if you're going to critique it, though.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you don't, you're out of touch with reality. And
yeah, obviously, a friend of ours. I don't need to say his name, but he's very much into cutting himself off completely from society and all culture.
Well, I mean, you can be a monk if you want to be. You can be a hermit and live in a cave if you want to be. But if you have not seen anything, you cannot critique it. If you have not read anything, you cannot say it's false. If you have not seen anything, if you have not actually looked at something, you're being very falsely judgmental to say it's ugly. And the only way you can understand the world that we actually live in is by experiencing it, and by experiencing it as much as possible. And, you know, sometimes it's even enjoyable, and that doesn't mean that we have to like every single thing about it. We are part of this world, and we need to understand it, and we need to live in it, and we need to be real. We need, church we went to yesterday. I don't know if you saw the motto that says we were not brought here to be perfect. We were bought here to be real. And I think it's a very, very, very valid point. Being real is much more important than being perfect. And again, that goes back to what I want to say, and I do want to say that the mythology of this, and I think that this is directly related to the fact that Obama is president, that we have this spate of movies and popular cultures, episodes about the South and the history of race relations in the United States. I have not seen, I also refuse to go see Django Unchained. But all, just look at it. Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, Django Unchained, The Butler, and most recently, 7 Years as a Slave. Or was it 12 Years a Slave? 12 Years a Slave. Was it 7 or 12? I can't remember. Sorry. Are you still there?
Yeah, I think some of the things you wanted to talk about, I know the prison industrial complex and how that affects race relations.
Going back to this concept of racial reconciliation.
Well, let me just make a comment is I think we should save that topic for another show because we're already about an hour in. But I think I'll let you say what your ideas are for racial reconciliation in a genuine and honest way.
Well, first let's define what we're arguing against. All I can perceive from what I've read of the Episcopal Church's plan for reconciliation is that white people are going to apologize for slavery, say it was a terrible thing, and beg for forgiveness. I think that that is close to preposterous. It is close to preposterous for a number of reasons. It doesn't reflect historical reality. Black people invented slavery. This is almost like Kelly Clark saying, Megan Clark?
Megan Kelly. Fox News.
Megan Kelly on Fox News saying that Santa Claus and Jesus were both white, okay? Black people invented black slavery. White people did not invent black slavery. This is a key point, I think, that the church right now, at least the people I talk to in New Orleans, in the clergy, did not want to deal with at all, that the original creation of the institution of slavery in Africa is extremely ancient. It was a way of dealing with surplus population. It was a way of maintaining an ecological equilibrium. It was not unique to Africa either. It was actually very common in the Americas. I know this because I have a PhD in anthropology from Harvard University, and one of the civilizations I studied most intensely was the ancient civilization of Mexico. In Mexico, as in sub-Saharan Africa, you had warfare, endemic warfare, where one town would attack another town, take its population prisoner, or at least its male population prisoner, pretty much normally mostly male, and sacrifice some in elaborate ceremonies to the gods, and sacrifice others merely for the purpose of cannibalism. This system existed in the ancient Mexico. It's much studied in the 1970s. It was one of the big topics when I was first studying anthropology. And the question was not whether cannibalism and sacrifice went hand in hand in Mexico. It's whether the cannibalistic part of this was merely an ideological religious phenomenon, or whether it was economically motivated and nutritional necessity.
Well, basically, you made this point in your letter to the bishop about slavery, but basically the point they're trying to make is that there is something uniquely immoral about white people based on something that's happened to the past. So you even give that line, it's from Jesus, where he says that a man is not responsible for the sins of his fathers, but basically what they're trying to say is that white people had this unique sense of moral immorality or unique sense of guilt that no other group has.
Okay, and but I mean the whole point of racial reconciliation, then that is that they want us to apologize for that. And
so
I
it's not at all racial reconciliation. It's totally one sided.
Exactly, but that's what the church is advocating in essence. And anytime you have a totally one sided apology, it isn't really reconciliation because the person apologizing is always going to feel resentful. And the person to whom who receives the apology is always going to feel like it's kind of empty. And in fact, in this case, I think that what the Episcopal Church is doing is a particularly empty show because of precisely what I'm talking about, that it negates historical reality. It refuses to accept any element of the truth in how slavery got started, how slavery really came to the Americas, what the real history of slavery is. And it also negates, I think, the current, the post-slavery reality that I was talking about, you know, how it wasn't just the white South that was destroyed by the Civil War. It was also the black South. The blacks and the whites of the South were kept as second-class citizens, at best second-class citizens of the United States, for the 50 to 100 years after the Civil War started changing in the 1960s.
Basically most, if you look at imperialism, just as the United States existing American imperialism, that was sort of set the precedent for American imperialism. But imperialists tend to use some kind of morality as justification for their actions.
And the first moral imperialist act committed in the United States was the War of the North against the South. That was the first. I mean, we did not claim a moral justification for the invasion of Mexico in 1846. We were claiming that, you know, the Texans, we wanted Texas and California. It was an outright war of open conquest imperialism. Okay, it was pretty honest. It was pretty direct. It was pretty sincere. Just like slavery was honest, direct, and sincere. And this is another point when you mentioned the prison industrial complex.
I think, you know what, I want to talk about that, but I think we should save that for a second show because we're well over an hour. I think
you're going to have to edit this thing heavily.
Yeah, definitely. But I think before we wrap it up, I think let's talk about what is your idea of a genuine form of racial reconciliation?
That we actually discuss history and the present. That we actually discuss what are the real problems. For example, if we accept the notion that that justice is a commercial concept, that equality is a commercial concept, that all of these concepts are economic in nature, that law itself is about the allocation of goods and wealth in society, and that equal justice means the equal allocation of the benefits, basically the ability to pursue happiness or the fruits of the production of happiness, then in that case, racial reconciliation is not the issue at all that we need to be working on. We don't need to be classifying people even racially to make real reconciliation. We need to look at who's actually poor and why. We need to look at who's actually unemployed and why. And if race could be a motivating factor, for example, if building up black communities could be more positive than integration, would the world be a worse place today if we reversed the policy that's been going on since 1945 and instead of integrating the black and white communities, what if we built up local communities and if they're white, they're white, and if they're black, they're black, and we tell them that their race is a reason that they should help each other, both on the black side and the white side. If we treat race as extended family, might that not be a better motivating ideology to get people to do the best they can and to actually develop their full potential than saying, you're poor because this white guy over here has more than you have? How is that how is setting up that kind of competition that you compare, you have to compare each pair of people? He's got more than I've had. They've got more than we have. Those people over there have more than any of us. You know, if you set up categories where everybody's competing with each other, it's going to be divisive. If you set up categories where people, instead of envying each other, are actually going to build themselves up, this is our black community. We are going to make it the best. This is our white community. We are going to make it the best. My grandfather, again, referring to a person I always, often refer to in these things, he taught me a lot of what I know about ethics and morality in the world. He, in his business, always had his employees compete with themselves. He always gave the highest rewards in his company to those who exceeded their own previous productivity. He never set them one against the other. He never said, I'm going to give the highest award to the highest highest producer in the company. I know who it is. I'm not telling you who it is. I don't want you to compete with each other. I want you to compete with yourselves. If you sold 10,000 this month, I want you to sell 20,000 next month. I want you to sell 100,000 next year. And that kind of competition, I think, is the kind of competition that a segregated world or merely a non-racial world could achieve. But you have to have a sense of community. There has to be a sense of who it is that's actually doing something. And I feel that the continuing whining about how, on average, blacks do not have as much as whites, that is divisive. That is setting whites against blacks, and it's setting up race as basically the false measure of achievement. What we actually need to do is we need to say, if you're a community, how can you make this community better? How can we build this up? How can we take a poor place and make it richer? How can we take a poor person and make him more productive? How can we make him independent? And what I learned in my explorations of East LA, South Central LA, Watts, Compton, what I learned about these parts of Los Angeles is equally true of New Orleans and the entire United States. It is the modern system of dependency based on welfare and selling people on the idea that they've been cheated by the system that maintains the hierarchy. It is precisely...
Well, people have been cheated by the system, but in a different way than what they claim they are.
Well, I mean, cheating, unfortunately, is part of human life ever since, you know...
Yeah, of course it is, yeah.
You snuck that apple behind Adam's back. I mean... you know, it is in human nature, and we need to focus on that which is real and not that which is imaginary. And we need to have analytical categories that make sense both from a motivational standpoint and from a historical standpoint. And I think that basically overall, integration has been a failure. Integration has served to make white people and black people compete with each other in completely unproductive and false ways. I have this book here called The Affirmative Action Hoax. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's by a fellow by the name of Stephen Farron. And it focuses on a lot of the issues that we've been talking about. The subtitle is Diversity, the Importance of Character and Other Lies. And it shows how basically by setting up this eternal competition between black and white, the system has actually destroyed education.
Yeah, because no matter how much they push, there's never going to be total economic equality between different ethnic groups.
But what we need is a system that encourages each individual to do his best. And instead, what we have is a system that suppresses the best individuals because we have to accommodate the worst. And that, I think, is ultimately a very depressive depressing and self-defeating system where the best in society have to cut themselves down in order to accommodate the needs or the what you call the feel good the feel good ethos of the least well off. And I think that the interesting thing is identity and class are good motivators, and if we could just get away from this notion that thinking in terms of racial identity is bad, when all we do by saying thinking in terms of racial identity is bad is make certain people think more and more and more in terms of racial identity, I think we've created a system where basically there is some prestige and some great advantage in being an ethnic minority, because if you're disadvantaged, that's an advantage. I mean, can we get more perverse than that? That is what this book of the Affirmative Action Hoax is really about, is that, you know, as long as you're a disadvantaged minority, that's an advantage.
Yeah, we're going, I think with the time, we've gone like way over an hour. I think this is a good point to wrap it up. But I will have you back on, and we'll continue talking about these topics. But I want to do a special focus on the prison industrial complex and the criminal justice system as a whole. So, Charles Lincoln, I'd like to thank you for being on.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Robert. And I will talk to you later today, probably.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.